This is the poet and the poem from the Library of Congress. We are on location with two poets with new books, and we love cracking open those new books with Robin Dunn and William Heath. Now, each of those will read a poem right now from the book, and they will explore through this time how they got where they are and what they think they're doing. So, Robin, we'll start with you with an opening poem. Robin Dunn.
Thank you. The poem is called A Matter of Locution. Be wary when my words enter the room. You'll know them when they're here. They heft a keen lexicon, fat with thin air, out of which they'll snatch themselves stylishly, as though from a hat. Here, see them dance over your doorsill, balancing syllable and sense on the edge of a tongue. Such a fine stunt, so ornate with suspense. What next from their fun box of tricks? A lyric or two? An illusion at play? Riddles? Translations? Word of the day? But be wary still of their high wire act. Easily they'll claim as their own those lips from whence their life breath's blown. They'll dance veils over nuance, extrude fable from phrase, fly backflips through what's meant, and coin toss the plot. You might then just hear something even their author has not. Soon, in a rush, my words will be gone, slick with their suave sleight of sound, praying you'll still see fit to unbar the door whenever next they come chattering around.
Robin Dunn, you will know him by that Scottish accent and that Shakespearean locution. It's a pleasure. We'll be hearing more from him. And William Heath is here with a new book and a new poem. Here's William. Can I call you Bill?
Oh, sure. I'm going to read the title poem of the book. The book is called Prime Time. And so this is Prime Time. A little tongue in cheek. My wife, I am sure of it, is having an affair with a guy who drives a truck, drops by on a regular basis, leaves her nicely packaged presents on our front porch. I bring them in to hand over to her and don't stand around until they're open. I want to be discreet about all this. We're both mature adults. I respect her freedom and independence, so we don't talk about it. I swallow my pride, yet dread the next day, his next visit. The cocky devil even rings the doorbell, leaves his gift, and drives away in the same truck as always, the one with Prime on its side.
And your title of your book is Prime Time.
Prime Time. That's
perfect. Cool. Perfect pun. Well, since we have you in the light for the minute, Bill, I want you to describe this new book you've just been reading from. What is in it, and what do you think you're saying in this book?
Well, it's not unlike some of my other books. I think I'm noted for a kind of wide range of topics. I have some autobiographical poems, and then I move on to the social commentary. The book ends with some poems about philosophers and religion and so forth. And so I think that I'm a 60s person, and I think my poems have a kind of ironic wit to them. And I speak in the American idiom, and so my poems are fairly clear and easy to follow. I started out in the 60s, and then there's a huge interim there where I was writing history and fiction and critical essays. And then I've returned to writing poetry when I retired. And since then, I've published four poetry books and three chapbooks. So
yes, let me name them. Bill Heath has published five poetry books: The Walking Man, Steel Valley Elegy, Going Places, Alms for Oblivion, and Prime Time, and three chapbooks and three novels. Let us hear a poem from Prime Time, or what book would you like to read from?
I'm going to stay with Prime Time since it's the most recent book.
We'd love to hear a poem.
Despite the title. This book is not, or this poem is not directly about you. It's called Grace on Skates.
Oh.
The best skaters glide backwards on the ice, more swiftly than forward, short skirts whipping lithe legs. This skating in reverse is a kind of miracle, as if the act made time go backwards too. She already looks young, but could I see her become younger yet? I think so. Perhaps it is a secret of ice skaters, why skating backwards is grace in motion, a defiance of the laws of life. No wonder when she leaps and spins, suspended a moment in the air, time and gravity in abeyance, I can even believe the world ceases to turn, stand still before our mundane lives resume.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the first ice skater who won the Olympics in 1932?
I certainly do not.
Sonja Henie. Sonja Henie.
I certainly know that name.
I have a Sonja Henie doll, and that brings, that poem is wonderful because it brings that rush right back to me. Good. Thank you so much. And Robin was born, Robin Dunn is next. He was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and was raised in Ghana, a country he still visits and does some philanthropy there. And he majored in linguistics and phonetics at the University of Edinburgh. Whatever that means, we'll find out. So give us a poem in your rich Scottish brogue.
Oh, you want another one? My, you must like me. Okay. this next poem is the last one. It was the title poem of the collection I have, which is only one poem. But this one is called Se Salinas Formentera. And a bit of preamble. Formentera is a very small island in the Mediterranean. It's off the coast of Spain. It's only a few miles long and maybe a couple of miles wide. You can't get there except by a small boat. People there spend their time fishing or in the salt production. That's one of their main industries. There's not much going on. A footnote that might be of interest is that Formentera is the island where James Taylor was when he wrote one of my favorite songs, Carolina in My Mind. That I didn't learn that until later, but that's where he was. So I always like that little bit.
Well, if you ever get on Jeopardy, you'll know that. Anyway. Let's hear a poem from your new book.
It is. And the title, Se Salinas, is Catalan, because that's the language thereabouts, and it just means, more or less, the salt fields. So he goes, Se Salinas Formentera. At that day's rise, a strange ice came, set tight at sea surface, sudden and clean. We stopped. Pure salt where water had been. Lying brilliant and bare, the stuff of tears out of its birth pool by hard sun unsealed had grown a crusted and glittering yield. Stone-brown men came later to crush and crack sharp crystal to rubble and rock. They hammered on, the substance the same, the symmetry gone. Later, we reflected its light in a pine-deep dusk with salt in our eyes, as our silence set free the hushed slide of a harvest returning to sea.
You will not know this, but Bill's wife is a Catalan novelist from Spain. So there's some serendipity here. Okay, you have studied locution and your field is in phonetics. What does that mean? What are linguistics and phonetics?
Well, linguistics is the science of language, essentially. It's not the study of languages, although certainly you couldn't do it very easily if you didn't speak at least one or two, including your own. And when I was doing it, our example languages were French, Russian, Swahili, and I think French we used as well. So that's what it is. It examines syntax and how language is put together.
Wow. How does that affect your writing? How does that I would have to put that on the back of my neuron, or it would get in the way of my poetry. That's too much knowledge.
Well, that probably explains something about me. I know too much.
And why you became a very productive book transactioner in the world. You're a bookseller, a bookmaker, and a transactioner in the literary world, which is so interesting. Let's hear another poem.
Another poem from me. Well, this one also needs a bit of a preamble because, as I discovered yesterday to my shock, this is supposed to be about American poets. And I'm not. I'm an interloper. I'm a Scot. That's my nationality. And that means that I speak in Scots, which, by the way, is a language. It has a living literature. People write novels and poems and music in it even today. One of the Booker Prize winners only about 20 years ago was written entirely in Scots. Anyway, that's as it may. It means that I use some Scots words, and I don't use too many because I don't want to be abstruse, but this poem includes a few. So if I can just help by saying what they were. The first word that I can see that comes up is outwith. That's probably self-explanatory. It's the opposite of within. Within, without, we say outwith. And it's very common. You'll see it in newspaper headlines, and English people can't understand. But then they don't, anyway. The Rhone is the gutter that runs along the edge of a roof, or more particularly, the downpipe from it. I believe it, in English, it actually means a kind of horse, but a roan is that. Slaister's a lovely word. My mum used to use it a lot when I was a wee boy, because slaister is the sort of word that describes the mess that a wee child makes when it's playing with its food, if you know what I mean. A midden is another kind of mess. It's a place on a farm where you chuck all the vegetable matter, and it's usually used figuratively these days. Stair means a step, just as it does in English, but also we use it mainly to mean the entire staircase. And one that you'll probably like, and it takes me back to ice skating, actually, because the word is birl, and birl means to spin or twirl around or something. It makes me think of a figure skater, actually. So that those are the words that I use.
Oh my, it feels like reading William Blake.
I hope, well, maybe not. So anyway, here it goes. The poem is called The Sadness Collector. So, November. Condensation blears the pane. Drear cloud stifles from outwith. A drum drip from the Rhone damn well won't stop. A baked bean slaster half left. A chill kettle on the stovetop. The sink's a midden. The clock up the stair, its clack-a-clack nut hard as a headache, could burl itself backwards and still never reach even 1 second gone. That's time's granite will. Hell, in the care of the crows, a man could credit he'd grown wings from the fluttering grief he aye greets as a gift. Sorrows enfold, their tears enrich. Three bars on the fire, the kitchen's clay cold.
I love that poem. Tell me the line about the kettle again.
A baked bean slaster half left, a chill kettle on the stovetop.
That is the saddest image you could ever imagine.
It's a sad poem. Poems are supposed to write sad things, aren't they?
Yes, it's our job. Yeah. Death and love and sadness. But I really like that poem. And actually, I'm going to ask you to read it again.
Oh, wow. Right now?
Yeah, because we have to get used to you.
Yes. Okay, well, that's good.
And I love the imagery, and I do love the listing that are evoke sadness. And actually, I get joy from it. So,
thank you. The Sadness Collector. So, November. Condensation blears the pain. Drear cloud stifles from out with. A drum drip from the Rhone, Dan well won't stop. A baked bean slaster half left. A chill kettle on the stovetop. The sink's a midden. The clock up the stair, its clack-a-clack not hard as a headache, could burl itself backwards and still never reach even 1 second gone. That's time's granite will. Hell, in the care of the crows, a man could credit he'd grown wings from the fluttering grief he aye greets as a gift. Sorrows enfold, their tears enrich. Three bars on the fire. The kitchen's clay cold.
Mm-hmm. That is sadness made permanent, which is what we like to do, making art. Thank you. And with Robin Dunn is Bill Heath. And he has, in addition to so many things in his career, written three novels, The Children Bob Moses Led, that won the Hackney Literary Award, The Black Snake's Path, and Devil Dancer. That's a work of history. William Wells and the Struggle for the Old Northwest, winner of 2 Spur Awards and the Oliver Hazard Perry Award. Bill, you're a historian. You're a poet. You're a professor. How does the poetry and the history blend? And the novel writing, how do you write a novel?
Well, that's a good question. My PhD is in American Studies from Case West Reserve. And so I'm actually trained in literature and in history. And when I came to Kenyon, which, as you know, is a famous place for literature, I decided to become a poet. And so for the first decade of my career, I was a poet. But poetry is not a way to get tenure, I found. And so I got switched over. I was denied tenure, I should say, at a couple places because I was simply writing poetry. And then I went to Seville as a Fulbright. And there I wrote my first novel. And when I got my next job at Mount St. Mary's University in the States, I wrote literary essays and novels and history to secure my tenure and promotions and so forth, and was putting poetry more or less on the back burner. I continued to write a few poems and publish a few, but it wasn't my center of attention. And then once I retired, I returned to writing poetry, and I've been doing that exclusively ever since. So I'm trained to do both history and literature, and I think they combine well. I think my history books are poetic, and my poetic books, I'm not stressing those today, but I do a lot of history and tell stories in many of my poems.
Yes, American Studies is alive and well in poetry. We have a great picture of our culture through your books, I can tell you. And so give us 2 poems in a row so we get a good, healthy portion.
Okay.
Set them up. Please set each one up for us.
Okay. These poems are mainly comic, so I'm kind of counterpointing to Robin's sadder poems. I'm hitting a lighter note in the poems I'm reading, although I do write sadder poems. This poem is entitled Killer Whales Attack Yachts off Gibraltar, and it's actually a true story, although it doesn't sound that way. So here we go. They're not budding revolutionaries out to get the fat cats on deck, nor is their goal to free the oceans of all those large, sleek interlopers churning up the waters. Yet gangs of orcas have struck hundreds of yachts, sinking a few, and will not stop. The cause of this populist revolt? It's the rudders, stupid. It seems teenage killer whales began nosing around these new toys, bumping their heads and such. But if you and your sweet 16 pals happen to be 12 feet long, you can do a massive amount of damage. It's a kind of fad, experts say, like the time orcas began wearing dead salmon as hats. That was a lot of fun. And this is just a thrill-seeking game with dangerous consequences. And now the bluefin tuna are back in abundance, teenage whales don't need to take all day hunting for food. This boring period of affluence leaves them with a lot of free time on their fins. So why not see who can smack a yacht the hardest? Let's even try to make one dive.
Bill Heath. He's also written a collection of interviews, conversations with Robert Stone. Who is Robert Stone?
Robert Stone, I think, is one of the best novelists of the 60s, 70s, 80s. A couple of his novels were made into films. And he writes very gritty novels about the underside of things. Dog Soldiers may be his best-known novel about smuggling dope from Vietnam back into the States with all kinds of complications involved.
What triggered you to want to identify him and feature him particularly?
Well, I did one of the very first interviews with him, for one thing. When he came to Vassar, I interviewed him because I thought he was a major writer. My PhD is actually in contemporary American fiction. And so I made a point, certainly, during those decades to find out who were the best novelists.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Stone is certainly one of them, although fame being what it is, people don't know his name anymore. Although Who Will Stop the Rain is maybe one of the movies based on a novel with Nick Nolte that people might have seen. But he's a major, major writer, one of the very best of his decade.
Well, as expert in fiction, do you want to name a favorite of today that you might be reading besides your wife's wonderful novels?
Well, one of the problems is when I switched over to poetry, I stopped keeping track of everybody.
That's what happens.
And so I can name a bunch of favorite poets, but I don't think I can name a favorite novelist right now. I've been searching. I've been very conscientious trying to find poets I admire and like. And
it's true. Poets read poetry. I was telling a fiction writer that the other day. I'm not up on my fiction because poets really read poetry. Well, we're going to get back to, because I want to hear about how you won the Lifetime Achievement Award and what you did to win that. So, Robin.
Yes.
You have, I thought I knew you. I knew you were a head of the bookstore at St. John's College. I knew your reputation. I saw you perform in a piece of theater. We love your recitations of Bobby Burns. But
That would be Robbie. Bobby is English.
Oh, excuse me. See?
Robbie, actually, we say.
It's a good thing I had you on today. But I did not know that you were an expert in commercial aviation. What's up with that? When did that start?
Yeah, I've been interested in aviation as long as I've been interested in words. I made my first flight when I was 3 years old and went to the cockpit and fell in love with it. And that was on the flight that took me out to West Africa, where I then spent the next 12 or 15 years and went to school. And I lived near the airport and just loved planes. And ever since then, I've been writing about it. And I've written books and magazine articles, that kind of thing, on that subject. And to my great pleasure, you don't get people who write books on things like commercial aviation where the reviewer said, this is very well written. Well, that actually happened to me on my first book. So I like to think I bring a bit of poetry into that because it's all about helping the reader to understand.
Oh, you're so true. Lyrical writing doesn't hurt journalism a bit, does it?
No.
But just summarize your knowledge of aviation. Just tell us your passion about it.
Well, my passion is I love the engineering aspect of it, although I'm not an engineer at all. But I like many different aspects of it. I simply like the history. I like the way that it's developed. And I also like the way it's affected human life and I have a great liking for, there's a whole mythology about flying, for example. You know, when people started flying 125 years ago, there suddenly was a great deal of, there was an outpouring of interest in aviation. And interestingly enough, even women in aviation did especially well, because there was this idea that we were at last doing something that humans had always wanted to do, and it had this magic to it. An aviator would get into a plane and get up and go off and fly way beyond the horizon, disappear, and then magically come back.
That is very poetic. Thank you so much. And so you have just earned yourself another poem to read.
There's a wee bit of Scots in this one, but not too much, so you can manage, I'm sure. It's called capercaillie. And capercaillie is a bird very emblematic of Scotland. It's a bit like a fat pheasant mixed with a small turkey. And the reason I wrote this poem was I got a fright when I read a headline saying there were only 500 left in the whole country. And this was 2 or 3 years ago. So this was my response. Capercaillie, which, by the way, is, I couldn't even begin to pronounce it, but it's an anglicization of a Gaelic word. So now it's our capercaillie's goodnight reel. Does destiny, having made a world too rich, dare to discard with scant care or word, and banish from pine and blaberry pitch that throat cluck and skip, that furtive bird? No, ask not fate to carry alone this weight. Fist clenched within the grasp of thieves who've seldom kent a love-lent hole, here lonely providence powerless grieves to yield such good for a greedsome goal. If harsh impulses hazard every neck alive, ever ready to cut down creation to size, these are perils not of fortune, but from us. If light willed in its witlessness the sun not to rise, neither capercaillie nor we would ever take flight. Know those fools are as destiny drawn as us all. Confounding life with their outrageous plan, they see not your end will also be theirs. Dance on, dear bird, ever unfold your flamboyant fan, amaze with your strut and play. Then you're gone.
Wow, that was pure music. Pure music. Was there a form? Were you using form?
I use a sort of rhyme scheme. Sometimes I do. I find I like to use form fairly often because it concentrates me on getting the most economical meaning. It kind of constrains me in a good way.
Well, everyone wants to constrain you in a good way, right?
Yeah, right. Especially so I've written this with usually with two rhyming couplet at the end. That's pretty much what I do, and I've made the lines scan as well, more or less.
You certainly have.
I do that in about half my poems.
Yes, you do. So everyone's going to want to buy your book. Tell us what the name of it, where they can get it. Is it on Amazon?
Yes, it is on all the usual places online. And it's called A Matter of Locution. And I go by the name RJ Dunn on the cover.
D-U-N-N.
D-U-N-N. And it's published by Clear Conundrum Press.
Well, it's the first of many, I know.
I hope so. I'm still writing, so I hope it does. And yes, I would love you to be able to go and buy it in your neighborhood bookstore as well. Although first they have to hear a bit more about me, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is important information because our bookstores are on the wane, and we are now using the internet to sell books because the neighborhood bookstore sadly is almost a thing of the past. There's so much that we are losing. Bill Heath is with us as well as Robin, And I'm very interested in your career, Bill, because it's a rich one. You are a professor, and you received a Lifetime Achievement Award for this. What do you think after, is it 35 or 40 years of teaching?
40-some years of teaching, yeah.
What do you think that your students would remember you for? One thing that you think was different from other professors?
Well, I taught both American literature, American history, and creative writing, and I think students in the different classes would have different memories. I tended, nowadays it's sort of popular to teach just excerpts of works, and I taught full novels, and I usually taught difficult novels. So I think some of my students will remember me as making them read some difficult works.
Wow, we should never just read excerpts.
Right, well, that's become the fad, and I never, ever gave into that fad. And but, you know, the ability to read is on sharp decline. Mm. In poetry, I think my students would best know me as someone who wanted them to revise and revise. I have a poem called Greenhaven where I taught creative writing at a maximum security prison. And one of the inmates told my friend Frank Burgon, who was mainly teaching the course, he said, when is Heath and his knife coming back? And Greenhaven has about 500 murderers, you have to understand. And Frank said, what do you mean, Heath and his knife? And the inmate said, that guy sure can cut.
So you went out into the community as well as in the walls of the college.
That's right. So that, and I actually brought students from Vassar to Greenhaven one time. I taught a course called Crime in America, and I brought my students, and we had a question and answer session with the inmates about
that. Had to be a tender subject. It had to be a very tender subject.
Oh, it was tricky. And I later learned on the Forensic Files show that Greenhaven was known as one of the most dangerous prisons in America, and that a female guard was murdered there a couple years by an inmate, a couple years after Frank and I were teaching this course.
Well, poets are dangerous by nature.
Right.
You just had to act it out. Well, what do you think you did as a teacher?
Well, I think, again, FAD's being, I think mainly American literature is taught nowadays for students to talk and say, what did you feel about this and that? And I think I taught with my main allegiance to the author. I wanted students to understand why this was a good book and what was going on in it and what they were catching and what they were missing. So I was much more opinionated, you might say. I didn't just read a discussion class. I wanted to steer students toward what the book was actually about and what the author was actually doing. Not that there's an absolute truth to this, but I think if you know writing, you know more or less what a writer is accomplishing and not accomplishing.
I think that's an excellent answer. It sounds like an excellent life of teaching. Really. So let us hear a poem from your new book and tell us the title of it again.
Prime Time.
And give us a poem.
Okay. Greenhaven is a little too long to read. I have that poem is in here.
Oh, good. Well, people can look for that.
That's right. I think I'll read one of my sort of playfully philosophical poems called The Spin on Things. In many sports, the secret is a spin on the ball, the tight spiral of the skilled quarterback, how the gifted shooter knows to pronate a wrist to create the right backspin on a basketball, and the talented pitcher snaps off a sharp breaking curve or slider. Even in soccer, you can apply a foot to add a furious twirl to a ball, finding the far corner of the net. To say nothing of tennis with its top spins and drop shots, are golfers flaunting a whole cartful of clubs, each designed to send a whirling orb sailing a predetermined distance. Let's admit that it's godlike, this spin that keeps our globe afloat in the vast sea of our galaxy. the whole damn solar system circles on itself and expands beyond the reach of thought. We even like to assume our little rotating sphere of a planet has a goal in mind, as this our world interminably turns and turns.
You know what I love about poets? Everything matters. Mm-hmm. You can write everything. You can write about the spin on things. And we're going to have a final poem from you, William.
Okay. I think I'll read the last poem in the book, which I hope doesn't sound too self-pitying. It's meant to be ironic. It's called Curmudgeon's Lament. But literary reputation I have, sorry to say, is in remission. If you're a serious writer in America, seek a goal within reach, neglect. I've been to Greece, hiked the slopes of Mount Parnassus. They are littered with sheep droppings. I will die the death of a curmudgeon, sour grapes caught in my craw. Fame is a game of musical chairs. Who sits or lacks a seat at the table is willy-nilly a whim of fashion. As an artist, I've cultivated the art of going unnoticed. Sometimes in the morning, I forget my own name.
As we all know, Bill, the act of writing is the reward in itself.
That's right.
Yes, and a final poem from Robin Dunn.
Okay, it's interesting, the Curmudgeon's Lament, because the last poem in my book is called The Questioner's Prayer. But anyway, here's my final poem, and might be the end of the program, but actually the poem is called No End. Is it possible to stop love on the spot? To turn it off as you do a tap? You might as well expect to unspin a tornado. Than love, only infinity does better, having needed no start. I watch the world, assured that land, sea and land will end. I dream of dead still tornadoes, of dried up taps. I dream of evaporated sea, and yet still you are here. And it begins again.
Thank you both for your beautiful dreams and your significant contributions to our culture. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We have been on location with Robin Dunn and William Heath. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. The series is post-produced by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank those who helped fund the program: the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family, friends of the program, Natalie Canivore, Sandy Jackson Cohen, Avi Deshashani, and Young Ki Kim Renault. Thank you. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.